Welcome back, everyone, to today's Brexit podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hemming, and today I welcome back a very special guest. He's been on the show a couple of times doing our weekly reviews, our extremely popular weekly reviews, which have been really well received. And say hello, everyone, or maybe Ollie Dugmore, say hello to all the listeners.
Hi, welcome everyone. The show. Thank you very much, Tim.
Yeah, glad to be back. Thank you. We always, when we get you on, we tend to record quite early, so apologies for anyone if we're still kind of half asleep doing this. But we will try and keep it upbeat and interesting all the way through. Reason we got you on is because very exciting news in the expanding world empire of the Brexit podcast. We want to get some different voice on. We also would like, given how well your shows have been received, to get you on to do some more interviewing, or to be an interviewer, I should say, with some guests. So that's exciting. Welcome to the team. Hope you enjoy it and hope you stick around for a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, fingers crossed I'll make it to the next 100 episodes. It's a pretty good time. To be joining.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, we had some nice comments back, Abby, from our 100th episode. Like, if anyone doesn't know, we've been going for just under a year, and we've done 100 episodes now. We had a few nice tweets. Some guy tweeted us from Canada. Bless him, Joe. Thank you ever so much. So you've been listening since episode one.
Shout out, Joe.
Yeah, that's a lot of his life he's lost there to us. But no, I mean, that was terrific, and I was kind of very touched by that. And also on that. That was our most listened to day ever when that came out. So that was nice. And we're heading in the right direction in terms of, I guess, in terms of all things Brexit with our unique style on tackling Brexit, Ollie.
Certainly feels like you guys have done all the hard work and I'm just sort of moseying in.
Well, hopefully you can add a bit of polish to this.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, right? This is, you have a bit of a burgeoning, hopefully, media career, and maybe I've oversold that massively already.
Yeah, just a little.
Yeah, but it's definitely in your area of interest, which is why I wanted to get you involved. So the first time, what we want to do with today's show is introduce you a little bit, and I was thinking back, and the first time I met you was when you came in to do some work experience. I was work at a journalist at News UK. You came in to do some work experience,
yeah,
and you were
right.
An editor of the student online website, The Tab.
Yeah, I was the Cardiff editor for The Tab. I was still at university. That was in my last year. So yeah, I was 21. That was nearly 3 years ago now.
Yeah, so old. we had a few editors in over about a fortnight's period for that, and I met and worked with a few of them, but you particularly stood out for your for being quite nosy, I seem to remember. for being interested, but also you love of politics, really, or certainly a deep interest in politics. So where does that come from?
My I was always interested in politics from when I was at school, but sort of rather cornerly, I just had a really, really good politics teacher who was also my head of sixth form. And he just, you know, when you meet someone who is sort of consumed by enthusiasm for a subject,
yeah,
it's infectious.
Yeah.
And that rubbed off on me. I began to take more of an interest myself, just as a byproduct of his teaching, to be honest with you. Did it for my A-levels, did it at uni, and then all of a sudden you sort of get to the end of a university degree and realise you spent the last 5 years of your life studying something, and you actually have a bit of a personal interest in it.
That'll be him now on the
texting
in.
Stop it! Stop talking about me. Yeah, and so I bought myself a Noam Chomsky book and sort of radicalised myself.
Right.
And then sold out when I got offered work experience at the Conservative Party. So a year or two later.
How was that?
Yeah, really good. Really enjoyed that. Met some really interesting people. Worked on the European election and also the 2015 general election as well.
So you've seen the dirty inner workings of political party?
Yeah. Full of backhanded deals and shady goings on.
Yeah.
No, the Cardiff CCHQ was a very pleasant place, and as far as I was aware,
Yeah.
There wasn't a great deal of underhand dealings with Cardiff North.
No, but I imagine if they got a politics student from university coming in on work experience, they were pretty
careful.
Yeah, they're pretty careful about what they showed you.
Yeah, no doubt.
So tell us a bit about your role as one of the editors for the, or maybe explain what the tab is first,
because
it's an interesting concept. We were just chatting before the show. It was actually something that an idea that I sort of half tried to launch my brother years ago, right at the start of the .com boom, and we didn't probably, it was, you know, let's say it was too early in the internet's existence for that to have had any chance of taking off, which kind of masks over the fact that we didn't have a clue what the hell we were doing. But the tab's been rather more successful. So tell us what exactly it is, and then kind of what your role was.
Yeah, sure. So the tab is a student newspaper. It started in Cambridge in 2009, and it was basically an alternative media, if you like. You know, invariably, paper student newspapers, I mean like physical newspapers, are pretty boring. The writing's often self-serving for the journalists rather than their audience. And Jack Rivlin, who's the CEO, decided that he wanted to start a newspaper that people actually wanted to read. So him and two other guys founded it. Fast forward to now, and it's at 50 universities in the UK, another 50 in the US, with plans to be at over 100 by the end of the year. And each university has their own individual website that's ran by a local editor and a local team of student journalists. And then there's sort of like a central hub in London and in Brooklyn, New York. The London one is in Shoreditch, obviously. And they sort of remotely help out with training and social media, website admin. You know, there's sales team, tech dev team, and then editorial journalists as well. And so I was a part of that London team previously, after having been the Cardiff editor. I was the audience development editor, which for people outside of journalism, sort of newspeak, that's like social media, video, all that kind of stuff, SEO.
Right. And you sort of talked about the setup there, which sounds like quite a lot of hard work. So does any dosh change hands with this when you're a student editor?
Yeah, certainly. So when it's very much like a news agency. So if you have like a story that goes big that people have an interest in, you take the pictures, you can sell the pictures. We also ran a sort of incentive scheme, if you like, for sort of stories that perform particularly well. People could get paid, and we also trialed paying the editors as well at the local teams. Invariably, we found that actually they were far more interested in us securing them work experience at places like The Times and the Sunday Times and The Sun, which is how I first met you. It was through work experience secured by the tab and other bits of training. Usually the money that we've offered people in the past hasn't really actually been that much of a motivating factor. But certainly to begin with, when people start writing for the tab, they're not paid. It's just, you know, training and experience opportunity.
And that's where it goes. And then in the tab as a whole, where does it make its revenues from? That's online advertising, is it?
Yeah, combination there is native. So, you know, a brand like Unilever, Spotify, you know, whoever might come to us and say, this is your area of expertise, not mine.
Nestle, a typical student-friendly brand, as a sponsor.
So they'll do native stuff. So that might be, you know, like a grad profile. Yeah. Maybe they're trying to push people to their grad scheme. So we'd interview like people who've recently done it, ask them about what they did at uni, etc., etc. Or also just, you know, your typical web advertising. So, you know, banners, pop-ups, sort of pop-ups. You know, things that hang off pictures, all that kind of stuff, like the page furniture, if you like, when you actually go onto the website. That's a really blossoming part of the company. I think in particular their revenue side of things is really innovative.
So you know, most people that roll around online through clickbait stories in the Daily Mail sidebar of shame, and that was my experience, and maybe sadly perhaps of being working in online journalism, is that a lot of the salacious sort of stories that you might call tittle-tattle is the ones that gets the big hits.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, that, I don't know if that was your experience as well. And also, what role would politics and then forward from that Brexit have to play? Did that make much of a big splash?
Yeah, so, you know, the I mean, students have always been sort of cartoonishly cast as like a radical left-wing group, and you know, politics is definitely a part of what the Tab does, and just on campus in general, outside of the Tab, you know, people care about it. There are SU elections every year. Admittedly, most people don't particularly care about those, but people certainly care about, you know, the wider national political picture. Brexit ties in really significantly because what goes alongside that sort of cartoonish radical stereotype is the other stereotype associated with students, which is they're completely apathetic and don't really care about anything else other than getting pissed. And Brexit unquestionably acted as a sort of a galvanising force, a catalyst. You know, young people, as a result of that vote, felt like they'd essentially been betrayed by their parents, by their grandparents, that their futures had been sold. And that's conversations I've had with, you know, students on campus, my people who I used to work with. They express a colossal amount of discontent and upset, and usually it's because, you know, they didn't participate in the referendum and feel like, you know, they've been left behind. And so fast forward to 2017 general election, and then all of a sudden you've got this bizarre sort of left of field, no one saw coming, Jeremy Corbyn mania that descends onto UK student councils.
Or maybe you did see it coming, though.
Yeah, so I mean, I saw it coming before everyone else did, but like only by a matter of like a couple of weeks, maybe a few months, because just by virtue of the position I was in, it was it happened really, really quickly, and it was as the general election did, I suppose. But yeah, there was a real feeling of, we're not going to let ourselves be let down again.
Because I know you did some broadcast stuff around that time, and yeah, you were on the likes of Sky News talking about this. The bright lights. Can you still remember the bright lights of West London there? Enough of Sky News HQ. But can you still remember the statistics? I mean, you're quoting the statistics of how many young people actually turned out to vote and how that partly swung the vote perhaps more towards the left.
So on the day, there was a figure that was misreported, that there was a 72% turnout amongst 18 to 24 year olds. That's not correct. I'm pretty sure, not that I've seen, so I'm fingers crossed to say that the full figures haven't come out yet, but they usually come out mid-autumn. But the sort of early indicators would point to about 54% young voter turnout, which, again, as you said, you know, it was a couple of months ago now, statistics aren't at the forefront of my mind, but I'm fairly sure that that's the highest number of young people voting in a general election, highest proportion of young people voting in a general election since 1997, Blair, and maybe Major before. But either way, the early signs would show that young people increased their turnout.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier that your role was to promote, you know, social media impact of the Tab as one of the things that you did. And it felt like that it was an election or a movement that was done away from the mainstream, a kind of underground, if you want to use that, do coin that cliche bit. But in that role that you do, where do you think that has the most impact? Is it a Facebook? Is it Twitter? Instagram? Or is it a combination of all of these things that galvanise people?
Yeah, Twitter's a really interesting one for me, because you log onto Twitter in the morning, and apart from, you know, like a few things from Dan Hodges and a few other people, it's just a colossally left-leaning sphere, if you like. But the important thing to caveat that with is that the UK Twitter user base, which is about 5 million people, is roughly the same amount of people that listen to Radio 4, and Radio 4 is not left-leaning like Twitter is. You can really get trapped in your echo chamber, and, you know, if you ask a student about what the conversation they think is happening around a general election, they probably assume that you were talking about social media, and Twitter is one of the first places you go to for your news and your political analysis. Disregard the fact that the exact same number of people are listening to, you know, a talk radio show, but that's alien really to the student market. Facebook is also really, really interesting, primarily because that's where a lot of organisation happens. That's where a lot of sort of local activists organise, using Facebook groups, Facebook chats. There are groups on Facebook with close to 100,000 members for people like Jeremy Corbyn to win 2017, and also their equivalents in the Conservative Party, although they're generally not as well attended. Jacob Rees-Mogg and his recent upsurge in popularity. He became popular on Facebook sort of about 6 months ago. There's a Facebook group and now a corresponding page called like Don't Clog the Mog. And
right.
It's just a collection of Jacob Rees-Mogg memes and, you know, his fans basically just chatting about how much they love him. And that corresponds to Jeremy Corbyn, although obviously he's slightly more high profile than Rees-Mogg at this moment in time, disregarding what he said on Good Morning Britain yesterday. But
and what did he say?
He said that he was totally against abortion.
This is Rees-Mogg, we should Jacob, clarify.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes, this is not Corbyn.
This is Jacob Rees-Mogg. On Good Morning Britain yesterday, saying that he was against rape in all circumstances. That includes rape and incest, because life is sacrosanct from the point of conception, and also that he disagrees personally with gay marriage because of his Catholic beliefs.
Yeah. So there was plenty of people lining up to clog.
To clog the mog in that instance. Yes.
Just on... interesting now, you were saying about the impact of social media. Just on Corbyn.
Yeah.
Became this kind of... much more than a cult figure during the general election with young people. You know, name chanted at Glastonbury and all of that. Do you think since then that halo slipped at all? I mean, you know, the election furore has died down for a bit. Since then, he's been firing his front benchers who are too pro-EU. He's a bit ambivalent toward it himself.
Yeah, certainly.
Do people start to look a bit closer at Jeremy Corbyn and think, actually, he's not the student messiah that they once thought?
Yeah, almost certainly. I think that, you know, that what comes with a surge in popularity is that if you're going to hold on to those people for the long term, then they're going to start analysing and scrutinising your political positions. And I'm fairly sure that a lot of the people who got behind Jeremy Corbyn in the general election weren't aware of his sort of long-held anti-EU beliefs that he's always held, very similar to Tony Benn in that respect. So he's still got a good bit of work to do. And the countermeasure to this, you know, the litmus test, if you like, is he's going to be scrutinised, and I'm fairly sure that he's going to lose popularity. But when the incumbent Prime Minister is so weak, I think he's going to be all right. There is still a lot of work to do in the House of Commons. Repeal bills coming up, and there are people who are suggesting there could be another general election, myself actually among them, this year. So I think the halo has slipped a little bit, but and there's still plenty more for him to do.
Yeah, just, you know, prophesizing there that there might be another general election coming up. You know, even this morning coming in, Brexit again has massively crowded the news agenda. A whole heap of new reports are going to be coming out as the repeal bill gets played out. There's a massive opportunity for the government's opposition, even people, Tories, who are not happy with the position Theresa May is taking, to pick at things. There's things like the Henry VIII, Henry VIII rule law, whatever we're going to call it, but which would effectively give the government unprecedented powers to make their own decisions. It's going to be challenged, rule by decree. Quite, thank you for that. I mean, all of this stuff is potentially putting a fairly slim majority in jeopardy, which I guess is what you're saying when a general election could be coming up. That's what it's hinting at.
Yeah, absolutely. That is what I'm referring to. There are sort of countless opportunities for the government to be defeated in the House of Commons. There are so many big decisions to be made and to be discussed, debated, and then eventually voted on that I suspect that is where a vote of confidence or a vote of no confidence will, in all likelihood, probably trigger a general election. I can't see, you know, I think it was this weekend just gone, or maybe the one before, where Theresa May was saying that in actual fact it wasn't 2019 when she intended to hang up her boots once Brexit's triggered, and that she's going to try and go the whole 5 years. And I think the concept of this Parliament surviving in its current state for 5 years is laughable. With the majority that they have, the Brexit decisions that are to come, even the ones in this week, I mean, we're 7 days into September, August has just finished, and as you've just quite rightly mentioned, I'm already beginning to feel a little bit of fatigue with all of the Brexit news that's coming out.
Yeah, that was the other thing that I wanted to pick up with you on Brexit. Is that people are bombarded constantly with Brexit news, but they probably feel quite helpless. Well, they are in largely quite helpless in terms of being able to affect anything. So in terms of being, you know, helping to do some hosting on the podcast, how would you see yourself dealing with that? We want to get stuck into the detail. It's something we've always tried to do on the podcast, but at the same time, we don't want to bore on to people.
Yeah, so this is why I think podcasting is such a fantastic medium, because it's as long as the conversation's interesting, I think it's pretty difficult to bore someone with conversation analysis and tone. Look, for me, Brexit is probably the largest political issue for the United Kingdom in decades to come, and potentially even from previous decades. It's massive, the ramifications that it's going to have for our country. And yes, it's almost certainly tiring to have to deal with seeing a word that until 3 years ago didn't even exist in our language on every single front page and talked about on TV and on the radio, sort of in perpetuity.
Impetuity. That's the one.
Yes, Tim. And, you know, yeah, it is tiring, but it's also incredibly exciting because of the significance and the size of the topic and its consequences for us, because make no mistake, it's going to affect every single one of us.
And in terms of interviewees and guests, is there people that you would like to hear from?
Yeah, almost certainly. It's big ones, you know, Michel Barnier, obviously, David Davis, obviously. I think to have an actual proper conversational interview with those guys and try and delve into beyond their top lines and, you know, their trotted out press remarks, which admittedly isn't something that's particularly easy to do. But, you know, speaking to those guys and getting the inside information on what their negotiations are like, that for me is fascinating. That when you boil it down and what it comes down to, and you look at, as I just mentioned, the wide-reaching consequences of this decision, and then it all sort of comes down to a room with them and their team sat opposite each other talking about stuff. It's sort of the most high-stakes power brokering that I think anyone in cabinet has certainly experienced for a very long time, and I find that absolutely fascinating.
Be a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
Okie doke. I think we're nearly going to run through for this episode, Ollie. Oh, I was going to ask you, and you've now left the tabs.
I have,
so
yeah.
So what are you up? I mean, this is not a full-time gig helping us out here, so unfortunately, yeah.
I wish it was.
Yeah, so what else are you up to?
So, yeah, I've, as you just mentioned, started here, which I'm really, really looking forward to. But then on top of that as well, I have just changed jobs to start working at LBC. As a content editor working on
them. What's LBC for people that are not...
It's a radio station.
Right.
It's a radio station, which you may remember earlier in the podcast, I was lambasting as a medium from people.
Irrelevant,
my age.
No one listens to you.
yeah, it's a radio station. You may have recognised... You may have seen some videos on Facebook from one of their presenters, James O'Brien, who's has a bit of a habit for going viral and talking about Brexit with his opening monologues generally. My job is making those videos, putting them on social, running them on the site, and running their website as well. Welcome to autumn, the leaves are falling.
So James O'Brien is quite pro-Remain.
Yes, he is.
That's his viewpoint, but there is some balance, right, with the radio station?
Yeah, there's a little bit of balance. Nigel Farage is probably the biggest counterweight to James O'Brien's left-leaning opinions. There's also Nick Ferrari, similarly, obviously not as radical as Nigel, but right-wing nonetheless. There's certainly balance. I think James O'Brien is, you know, very vocally left wing, but if you were to look at the station as a whole, I'd probably say he's probably in the minority.
And how long have you been there now?
Oh, a week.
Right. So, and what's your experience been so far?
Certainly, yes. Not, I haven't been there particularly long at all. I'm loving it. It's a fantastic environment to be in. All the people I'm working there with are very intellectual, analytical, it's a fantastic place to be, and I'm really looking forward to cracking on.
Great. So that's just about all we got time for today's show. Everyone, thank you ever so much for tuning in once again. The Brexit podcast has been brought to you by Tim Hemming, Jennifer Hahn, Warren Pohl, and today Ollie Dugmore as well.
Well, hey.
With the theme music by the one and only Kevin MacLeod.